And welcome to this episode of The Political Notepad with Josh Gillespie. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. I first met my next guest as a young and excitable volunteer on a congressional campaign back in 2004. Chris Spangle was the president of the IUPUI College Republicans and someone who was able to round up some good volunteers for the Andy Horning for Congress campaign. To say that campaign was a little unconventional is being generous. We lost, but it was a lot closer than people expected. Fast forward a few years, and Chris has had a roller coaster career on the professional side as well as in politics. He has been a radio show producer, an executive director for the Libertarian Party in Indiana, and now runs the successful We Are Libertarians podcast with his own We Are Libertarians podcast network, as well as continuing to produce other podcasts such as The Pat Down with comedian Ms. Pat, which he also co-hosts. He's also the digital director for the nationally syndicated morning radio show, The Bob and Tom Show. Please welcome Chris Spangle. Chris, thanks for being on the show this week.
Absolutely. So happy to be here.
You know, I was thinking about this a little bit earlier today, and it's very true. Just a few weeks ago, we were sitting down at a restaurant before the whole COVID-19 was kind of a thing. It was starting to spread.
We were just bright young men without a clue of our future, planning out what could possibly be, not knowing that disaster was right around the corner.
Literally, right around the corner. And I met you for podcast advice. And I said, you know, I was talking about I wanted to start a music podcast. And I remember the thing that you said that really stuck out to me. It was like, dude, we've been sitting here for an hour and all you've been talking about is politics.
Right.
And so because of you, this, well, not because of you, but you were definitely very integral in this podcast becoming a thing. A couple of previous conversations kind of, I think, were the seeds, and you watered the seeds, and I thank you, honestly, for this becoming a thing, because it's not a show necessarily about politics. It's a show about the journey in politics and trying to make it politics much more of a one-on-one conversation. It's meant to be getting to know more about people, the right people inside politics, and it's because of you that this is happening. So I thank you for that.
Well, good, because I will not apologize to you. I apologize to no man and few women.
Well, you should. So, you know, kind of getting back to the introduction here a bit, when I first met you, you know, you were a strong Republican. Now, you had some libertarian leanings, I probably would say, but you were a strong Republican. It was 2004. It was full on Bush. It was Mitch Daniels running in Indiana for the first time for governor. It was a good time to be involved in politics if you were a Republican, especially in Indiana. So give us a little bit, a taste of your background and how you've gotten to where you are.
Well, I grew up in a fairly apolitical household, but it was Republican. I remember my grandmother, she's unfortunately, you know, in the grips of Alzheimer's, but she's probably the feistiest person I've ever met. Like, when I think about why do I date feisty women? It's because of Mosh, my grandmother Marilyn. She was one of the most opinionated, spunky people you could possibly imagine, and I developed a love for talk radio driving around with her. She helped raise us, as my parents were, you know, mom was getting a nursing degree, dad was running a business, and she was a diehard Republican and stuffed envelopes for Reagan and Bush, and, you know, in her older years was so impressed that George Bush would send her a signed photograph every year on her birthday. You know, and she just was a hardcore Republican, and I think that's probably where, you know, we're all sort of born into one of the two camps. It's like a religion. It's you may not be Catholic, but you go to mass because your grandma does on Easter. And I don't know if that's what sparked my early interest. I think my interest in politics more springs from history. Those grandparents also had a place in St. Augustine. My parents, when I was a kid, had a place in St. Augustine, Florida. It's the oldest continuous city in the United States, founded in 1565. You know, I could go on for the next hour just giving you the linear history of St. Augustine, Florida. I just fell in love with it. I really enjoyed it. Like, I remember going on the horse-drawn carriage rides around town as they told stories about the town. And I just thought that was so cool. And, you know, history and politics are just so intertwined. And I remember watching Clinton get inaugurated when I was in third grade in 96 and thinking that was really interesting. And then shortly after that, that guy that I thought was kind of interesting got impeached. And, well, what does that mean in the history of it? And you're watching it. And I remember my parents going in to watch a movie, and I refused to go in. And so I sat in the car and listened to the Senate acquit Clinton during the impeachment trial because I was that into it.
Wow.
And I mean, I'm talking – so it would have been – I wasn't even high – was I in high school yet? I may have been in high school or just about to go into it. So I was always interested in politics and history and psychology and religion and kind of the liberal arts as a whole. And I don't know – I think it was 9/11 that really kind of – is what lit the fire to get active in politics, because my birthday is September 9th and I turned 18 on September 9th, 2001. Mm. And so, you know, and I always tell the joke that I turned 18 on September 9th. I signed up for selective service on September 10th and then I crapped my pants on September 11th.
Because, yeah. You know,
I think all of my classmates and I were sure that we were going to go to Iraq or at the time Afghanistan and then what became Iraq. And so politics for me became so much more personal because you're 18. It's incredibly formational for you. What's happening, you know, it's not just the event, but then all the conversation that came after it and all the war stuff. You know, I remember Greg Garrison helped me put on a pro-war rally, which was a quote-unquote support the troops rally in 2003, the Friday after Thanksgiving. And, you know, we were kicking off anti-war protesters, who I later became friends with and supporters of. And, you know, Steve Booyer and Dan Burton came and spoke at it, and I found the DVD of it, and it's really just – I can't believe that was me.
Yeah. But
it was just very informative. And so I don't know where my weird iconoclastic or libertarian streak came. I don't think I'm a contrarian necessarily, but I just have always rooted more for the underdog. And in 2004, I was the only college Republican chair not to work for the Mitch Daniels campaign. Most people get into politics because they're really invested in building a great career. Yeah, they're interested in the politics, but they understand that it's a great networking opportunity. I was way too stupid to understand that at the time. And Andy Horning, to me, just like, oh, well, this guy he's a Republican. He's here locally. He's got no volunteers. Why don't I go help him? And that turned out to be a horrible career mistake because – you know, Kyle Kasich, Carl Heck, all these guys ended up – my peers ended up with great jobs in the Daniels administration. Mm-hmm. But working on that campaign was a weird, fun experience. And Andy was a guy that challenged a lot of my rote Republican rehearsed talking points that I got from Rush and from reading Town Hall every day. And, you know, that campaign was the first time where – I realized something wasn't right with the Republican Party because, you know, we were getting alerted from volunteers that their campaign yard signs were being stolen, and we traced it back and figured out that it was the Mitch Daniels campaign that was doing that. And
say what?
The Mitch Daniels campaign was throwing out Andy Horning yard signs. And I later learned that it was because in the 2000 race, David McIntosh lost the governor's race because of Center Township, because I think it was Marvin Scott had run against Julia Carson and had given her a run for her money and had activated Center Township, and that swung the percentage of votes, and David McIntosh ended up losing, and they weren't taking any chances. And so when basically the campaign worker for Mitch Daniels told me that, I went, well, that just doesn't seem right. We're all in this together. We're all Republicans, you know? And the Marvin Scott campaign manager is telling me they're doing the same to him. And I'm like, what? So that to me was kind of the beginning of the cracks in the foundation, along with Andy and his very libertarian leanings talking to me about, you know, challenging my assumptions, because I didn't really know anything. I listen back now to even a few years later when I was on Abdul's show, and I hear myself and I'm just like, how dumb was this kid? I apologize to everyone who talked to me before 2010 because I knew nothing.
Well, to be fair to the listener, Andy Horning was a libertarian running as a Republican in 2004. He had previously run for mayor of Indianapolis in 1999. He's run for Senate and governor multiple times on the Libertarian ticket. But Andy, to his, I guess, credit, decided to take a leap and ran as a Republican in 2004. He had no money. He was out fundraised. Republicans, as usual, were not putting any investment into the 7th District congressional race. Julia Carson was a longtime congressman by that point. She was a powerful entity. And Andy won on name recognition because it wasn't money.
Right.
They recognized his name from him running for Indianapolis mayor in 1999.
Who did he run against in that primary? Was it Bob Crotty?
It was Bob Crotty.
Who later on went to be the first person that was willing or dumb enough to step up as the Trump state chairman in 2016 until the party took over with Tony Samuel and Rex Early.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Like that seemed like that was Rex's baby. Mm-hmm. So, golly, I look back on that time, a lot happened in between 2004 and 2010 within the party as a whole. I mean, we had the war in Iraq was starting to come apart, and deficits were continuing to drive high. Bush was under fire in 2006. The Democrats took control in 2007 on the national stage. And by 2008, that's when you started working with Abdul on WXNT. Is that right? Or was it a little before 2008?
It was before that. So I started at – and by the way, I first met you as I was College Republicans chair, Rob Green, who is
mm-hmm.
great guy, super intelligent, mm-hmm. working with Cluster Truck now. He introduced me to you because he said, Chris, this is the only Republican professor in the entire IUPUI network that will be our sponsor. so that's when I first met you, because you were like an adjunct professor who had – we had to have a college a professor sponsor, and you were the only one that he could find, I guess, that was willing to do it in 2004. And so, yeah, in 2004 in December, I sweet talked my way into an internship with Abdul. He had just moved here in September of 2004, and I had sent an email bitching to the program director Andrew Lee, saying, can you please stop playing this stupid Indians baseball? You're interrupting my Michael Savage time as I deliver it. And he said, hey, I used to deliver pizzas. What, have you ever thought about an internship? Because I told him I would love to work in radio. And so I went and talked to my professors, and I started for the next 6 months. I got up early every morning. I was late 75% of the time to my internship. I got a C on it. But I was really an idiot. I cannot now, knowing, being a professional radio professional, I cannot imagine anyone letting an intern do all the things that they had me do. They just gave me free rein. I got to hang out all the time. I was producing on air. He was teaching me how to run the board in the middle of a show. It was really irresponsible of both Andrew and Abdul, but it was such great experience. And I worked there part time. And when Andrew left to go to Tucson in 2007, they called me, and I just kept my foot in the door, and they said, hey, would you like to be the morning show producer? And I said, absolutely, because at that point I was such a loser, Josh. I was living in my mom's basement, working part-time for my dad as a janitor. I dropped out of college. I'd been laid off from the only full-time job that I'd had so far. Like, I couldn't get a date. I was just a mess. And so it was the one thing that I had going for me. And when they offered it to me, I was there all day, every day, all the time, and working my tail off. And it was a great year and a half education. And it was... it was really what finished me off from being a Republican, that experience working for Abdul, for a couple of reasons. Because you're sitting across from somebody who is super intelligent in Abdul and really just a pain in the butt. And
he is.
I talked to him today and, you know, we talk all the time. We talk probably once a week still after all these years, after 15 years. But he called today and I can't tell you what he told me, but I'm still laughing about it. So he constantly goes, I wish I could go back and play a tape of you now for you then, because you've really turned into me. And he's right, because I was such an idealist and I had so many like misconceptions because I had grown up with watching the West Wings of the world, and this is how politics really is, and all these lofty visions of what politics and government are supposed to be. And what I saw working for Abdul over that year and a half was a complete – it was all a lie. Like, you saw – you'd go cover – I was basically a reporter for Abdul, a stringer, and I would go and watch city councils and town councils and school boards and Democrat conventions and Libertarian conventions and Republican conventions, and you would just see the fragility of humans and – the just complete incompetence of organizations and how corrupt every single institution seems to be. And, you know, in 2008, I was the only person to cover all three state conventions. And, you know, I went to the Democrats first. I kind of hung around. Joe Donnelly came up and introduced himself to me. He was super nice. Like, I was like, that guy's going somewhere. You know, because he was just such a light, nice human being. You know, nobody really talked to me because of who I worked for, and I didn't really volunteer it too much. Then I went to the Republican convention in 08, and that was the end for me, because I'd been watching the debates and I had kind of liked Ron Paul, and I had been listening to boards and studying libertarianism, and it seemed to make sense, but I couldn't let go of the foreign policy aspect because I just didn't get that part yet. And then when Ron Paul was in those debates in 08, it just all made sense. That guy made sense to me. And I became a non-interventionist, you know, pretty quickly from there after, you know, reading some of Ron Paul's stuff. And then I go to the Republican convention, and I just remember this woman coming up to me, and she was kind of a middle-aged older woman, and she was crying. And she's like, "You have to tell this story." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she goes, "They've broken all of their laws. They've broken all of their bylaws. Their word means nothing. And they've just kicked all the Ron Paul delegates out of this convention." And I was like, well, that doesn't seem to make sense. Because, like, I'm very anti-conspiratorial by nature. So I have a high threshold of that kind of conspiratorial stuff. But the more I dug into
it... I feel like I want to make a libertarian and conspiracy joke, but I'm going to withhold from that.
Yeah, no, I'm not that libertarian. So it's driving me... That's what's driving me crazy. So there was a guy named Eric Rowe, who was an attorney up north, and he wrote a blog post basically detailing very detailed explanation of what happened. And, you know, I had one guy who, if I mention his name now, you'd go, wow, that guy's really high up in the Republican Party nationally. Mm-hmm. He goes, yeah, it absolutely is what we did. We kicked 300 delegates out of that convention because the National Republican Party did not want Ron Paul delegates to go to the convention. And that was the moment when I just had been saying to libertarians, change it from the inside. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to break the law and break their own rules to keep me from changing it from the inside. And so that's when I just was like, I'm going to become a libertarian. I wasn't making much money at the radio station. I started talking to Mark Rutherford and Tim McGuire at the local Libertarian Party. And that's when they hired me. And from October 2008 to November 2012, I had the best political education that I could never have paid for, because I was the sole employee full-time of a state political party. I was one of four at the time. There are no full-time state executive directors in the party now. But I was fundraising director, outreach director, recruiter, candidate trainer, campaign organizer, campaign manager. I did everything you could possibly do over those 4 years. I trained hundreds of candidates, recruited hundreds of candidates, led training events, taught Libertarian 101 classes. And it was really just such a fun job. And I still think about that all the time. You know, it had its ups and downs, and there were a lot of difficult personalities, like there always are. But it really was truly a great job.
You know, I was heavily involved in Indiana politics at that time. And I do remember that 08 convention. I remember there being some sort of chaos, if you will, about some delegates being cut out. Now, I didn't know what the whole story was. And honestly, because I wasn't a Ron Paul-like delegate, I don't think a lot of that, you know, kind of hit home with me.
Yeah, it didn't. But you didn't care.
I probably did. Yeah. That was crazies.
That's the attitude that people have.
Sure. That was my first state convention. I was also covering it for Hoosier Access, which was my blog at the time. I remember a lot of those things. And I remember when you went to the Libertarian Party, and it was when I was running, and maybe it's just because I was so involved, but I feel like it was when I was running that blog that I heard more about Libertarian candidates and the Libertarian Party and the influence. Like, there was more influence from the Libertarian Party during those 4 years than I honestly can ever remember before or since. And maybe it's because, you know, I knew you, and so there was that connection. But, you know, I just feel like there was a lot going on. I believe it was during your tenure that there was the first Libertarian on a major municipal city council. And was it 2012 that Rupert Bonham ran?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about your experience with the Rupert campaign.
So let me validate everything that you said nice about me. I have to give Mark Rutherford and Rad Klopfenstein their due, because in the early to mid 2000s, the party was really strong then. And then it kind of went dormant for a while. And then when they hired me, it was kind of a mess. And, you know, I had a 4-year strategy, and that first year was kind of getting to know everybody, getting an understanding of what was going on. I remember writing out all my goals for what I wanted to do there in a notebook. And you should see this notebook. It's hilarious. On the front cover, I have a Glenn Beck Constitution Watchdog sticker. And on the back, I have an Indiana Equality sticker.
There you go.
And I found it when I left the party 4 years later, and we had achieved every single one of those things. I never looked at the list again. And, you know, 2009 was really about getting to know everybody, kind of. You know, I knew it was going to be an uphill battle when I walked into the election night prep at the Marion County Party in 08. And, you know, you had witnessed a lot of my campaign experience. I mean, I was not an experienced campaigner. But, you know, I walk in, and so I kind of, you know, I'd watched Rob Green, who was just a brilliant guy, like at campaigns, and engineered this great Scott Keller win in 2003. And so I knew enough, right? I knew what you weren't and were supposed to do. Even if I didn't have a lot of experience, but, you know, it's like, so where are the poll watchers? What are those? Well, how many yard signs do you have for the county? 8? Like 8,000? No, 8.
Oh, man.
And I knew, that's what I was like, this is going to be a different experience. And so, you know, in 2010, it was a ballot access year. We swarmed the ballot. We ran 100 candidates. I think we beat... we beat the record. I think maybe Klopp had recruited more candidates 1 year, but we ran a ton of candidates. We learned a lot. And then 2011, we had that was the year that Ed Coleman, he had flipped parties, and he was running for re-election in a district, and we had $75,000 given to us by the National Party and had run against, you know, Jack Sandlin. You know, unfortunately, we didn't realize at the time how much straight ticket voting kills any chance of it's an incumbent protection system. Like, if you are a Democrat in a Republican area or a Libertarian anywhere, straight ticket voting means that the dominant party is going to always win, by and large. And so, you know, and so we rolled that large scale 2010 effort with with our Senate candidate, our Secretary of State candidate, all those candidates, rolled that into 2011 with Ed, and then we rolled that in 2012 into the Rupert campaign. And just, you know, it was a 4-year process of just building the party into something that was respectable. I mean, you know, the Rupert campaign had a headquarters downtown. It had an RV. It got a ton of attention. Rupert got more votes than I think any other candidate. Maybe Andy beat him that year because of Murdoch. But
well, it should be said real quick that this is the Rupert we're talking about here is Rupert Bonham of Survivor fame.
Yeah.
For those who may not know.
50% name ID. If you're a Libertarian candidate, there's no Libertarian candidate that has 50% name ID.
Yeah, I mean, so, he came in there with name ID like no other Libertarian candidate before him. And he didn't change his persona one bit. I think that's actually, in many ways, what was appealing about him, too. I mean, he was, if you've seen Survivor, you were familiar with Rupert, you know he's a guy who likes to wear a tie-dyed wife beater. And he was like that. I mean, you know, he wasn't.
Yeah, we went into that cycle with just my dream slate from Gary Johnson at the presidency to Rupert for governor to Andy Horning for Senate. It was there was a lot of internal strife between the different campaigns that caused a lot of pain. And so we didn't execute the right way, but we executed in a way like the party had never executed before. We were routing thousands of yard signs across the state in a way that had never been done before. It was really a great effort by a ton of people, and I'm thankful to have Sam Goldstein as chair at the time because he was just great at protecting me from the inter-party BS and letting me do the operations as I was able to kind of help, you know, we had guys like Chad Reed running twice for camp, you know, so it was just there were a ton of wins through that period. And the Rupert campaign was kind of the top of it for a lot of us. And it was an opportunity to make a big splash. You know, Rupert and I still talk every week. He's one of my best friends in the world. He's such a great guy. And Rupert gave up a lot to run that race. Rupert, I mean, it cost him a couple businesses. It cost him almost cost him his charity. You know, it cost him personally. It cost him financially. It was a very difficult race for him to run. He ran full time. He took it super seriously. And, you know, he earned all the votes in that historic vote. I mean, at the state fair, it was 17 days straight of grinding it out with we counted 7,000 people came through the booth to get a photo with Rupert. They're just never a candidate in the party's history that had that kind of energy around it, you know, and then went to the debates and, you know, up against Pence and Greg, and they were just predictable. And Rupert, you know, Rupert is not a professional speaker, and he knew he was in certain elements out of his depth on some of this stuff. And he was very nervous about a lot of it, but he rose to the occasion. But he and I still have regrets about that campaign, and we talk about it all the time. And the thing that we would do totally differently is we'd run Rupert from Survivor. We wouldn't run Rupert cleaned up. You know, we see the Trump phenomenon, and we go, we were early, and we were too – and this is a Libertarian Party trait. They're too insecure to be themselves. They want the major two parties to respect and like them, not knowing that neither of the two parties will ever like or respect them. The closest we ever got was Mitch Daniels, who is a Libertarian at heart, and his chief of staff, Eric Holcomb, reached out, and they realized that you could have two parties on state commissions, Republicans, Democrats, or Libertarians. We were a qualified party, so they started appointing Libertarians to commissions, so we started sending in lists. Mark Rutherford is still the head of the Indiana Defenders Commission. because because of Mitch Daniels' appointments. And so that's the closest I can name them on three fingers. That, Jim Banks coming to talk to libertarians about same-sex marriage in 2010 as a state house rep, and Richard Murdoch reaching out in 2010 wanting to come and speak to us. Like, that, those are the times that people took us seriously. in terms of the political establishment. So, you know, Rupert was a great chance for us to kind of to reach beyond just our own echo chamber. And if we were to do it all over again, we would do it where Rupert wouldn't dress up in suits and would be more of his own personality and appeal to the blue collar folks more than he did. And just kind of talk about more, you know, we were trying to please the party and we were trying to please the political establishment, and we lost sight of what voters really wanted, which Trump exposed a few years later. So, you know, but
I hear what you're saying in that, because I my reflections on 2012 is that, you know, I remember, maybe it's just because of Survivor, but I feel like I remember seeing Rupert out on, maybe not the campaign trail, but maybe it was at the state fair, more in character, so to speak. Yeah. But I remember him seeing him on the debate stage with Mike Pence and John Gregg, and he looked uncomfortable because he was in a suit. You know, that wasn't who he was. Now, I don't think you'd necessarily go into a debate wearing a tie-dye shirt and shorts.
No,
maybe he would dress these days.
The same for that. Yeah, I'm talking more our messaging and some of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So I could see how, yeah, he would probably, you know, he could get away with it more these days because of the Trump phenomenon. Now, we talk about, you know, Trump was a reality star, Rupert was a reality star, but yet how I see both of them in terms of politics is completely different.
Well, it's character. I mean, Rupert is, I've never heard Rupert say a bad word about another human being in all the hours I've spent with him. He is the most upstanding, empathetic, caring individual that I know. He's the complete opposite of Donald Trump. You know, so it makes sense that they're complete opposites in certain ways.
Yeah. Well, here's a kind of a, maybe a left field question for you based on how our conversation has been going, but I'm curious because I've asked this of previous guests, but I know you're a person of faith. What role has faith played in your politics now, whether that's been as a Republican, or how has it informed your politics, or have you let it inform your politics?
Josh, as you know, it goes God first, then country, then it is hugely important. It is the thing that is central to what I believe in many ways, but not something that I talk about all the time, because I feel that the Republican Party and the Christian conservative movement has tarnish the ability to integrate your faith and your politics. And I think that the emphasis on gay marriage killed the evangelical church and killed the Republican Party. And for a generation of people, you cannot connect Christianity to politics without it being associated with gay marriage. And, you know, I spoke out in favor, along with St. John, I forget his name, he's passed away.
Mark St. John
was a great guy, reached out to me. You know, I spoke out in 2009 in favor of one of the Senate or House resolutions, not wanting to put a cap in the Constitution defining marriage between a man and a woman. And I did it from a Christian perspective and from a libertarian perspective, saying the state shouldn't be involved, which I think he was nonplussed about. I mean, he wanted me to be a more liberal approach, I think is what he thought he was getting. But, I think for me, it's become more defining in a lot of ways. And I'm a libertarian probably more because of my faith than any other reason. I am a libertarian not because I like tax cuts and I am a conspiracy theorist that thinks the government's trying to control me. I'm a libertarian because I think it's the most empathetic, loving way to organize a society. And it deals with people who are the most vulnerable in a more humane manner, in a more efficient manner than the system we have now does. And, you know, I became a Christian after 9/11. 9/11 was, again, hugely formational for me. I was an atheist, and I had kind of started, I had read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha as a book report in 11th grade, and, you know, I'd been an atheist, and that kind of made me think a lot about Buddhism, and I got really into Buddhism for, like, you know, like typical high school stuff. You're like, I'm going to explore this, man. And then I started looking into Christianity, and 9/11 happened, and it shook me so tremendously that on that Wednesday I went to church voluntarily for the first time in my life, the Wednesday after 9/11. And I mean, that people don't realize there wasn't a single empty spot in a parking lot at a church in Plainfield, Indiana on that Wednesday. Everybody went. I had gone through a pretty rough breakup. I had, you know, from September to November, I had gone through a rough breakup. I had a lot of family issues at that time, and became a Christian in November of 2001. And it's the thing that has shaped me more than anything else, obviously, I think, as most Christians would say. And it has made me just a more patient person, a more loving person, a more empathetic person. I took one of those gift tests, you know, the church, the mega church I go to is trying to get you to volunteer. And so you take the spiritual gifts test. And
oh, yeah.
And mine, I thought it'd be leadership or teaching or, you know, and it turned out my main gift was mercy. And I'd never even thought of that as a gift, but, you know, I do the public affairs show for the iHeart indie stations called Now Hear This, and the main reason is to talk to these charities that are alleviating human suffering and to use my gifts to bring up what they're doing to educate people. Like right now, it's the need at food banks. Each food bank I've talked to, their need has doubled and their supplies have greatly dwindled. And, you know, because of my faith, I feel that and I see that, and I go, I'm blessed to be in the position I'm in, and I don't have to suffer, but there is suffering, and so therefore we need to be aware of it and alleviate that. And you know, one theme of the We Are Libertarians podcast has been that public policy has a human toll. There's a cost in human terms of public policy, and bureaucracy is incredibly cruel and uncaring. And if you're a person who is struggling, the FSSA, the people who work there, they have decent motives and they're decent people, but they, when you talk to victims of domestic violence, or you talk to people who are homeless, or you talk to people who are in any kind of serious life-threatening situation, what you often hear from these government agencies like DCS or the FSSA or the police officer or the prosecutor's office is, I wish I could help you, there's just nothing I can do. You know, and that maybe that would still exist in a totally free society where, you know, you have market solutions around everything. There's always going to be human suffering, but at least people wouldn't look to kind of a false savior in something like a DCS or a police department. And I'm not trying to put those people down, because there are genuinely great people that I talk to weekly working in these government agencies. They're not there because they want power. They're there because they're working for a prosecutor's office, because, you know, they deeply feel what the victims of crimes feel, you know, and they're willing to take that pay cut to do this. But the reality is, it fails too many people, and it becomes a false hope. And so you get a child who's been abused or a woman who's been abused, and the doctor calls DCS, and they feel that they've done something, and they feel that they've saved that child. And when in reality, that child probably has 14 other DCS reports, and there's somebody going, I do something, but the dad who's being accused has a lawyer, and we can't set an appointment, and it's just been 2 years, and there's nothing I can do. My hands are tied, you know? And so the system that we have doesn't work on the individual level from a human perspective. it's cruel, it's uncaring, and it needs to change. And so if you're going to usher in something that is compassionate, what is that system? And it is libertarianism. It is a market system. It is something that we're seeing in action right now. As there is great suffering, you see an Amazon, a CVS, adding jobs to their balance sheets, or companies are donating more cash to food banks than they've ever donated before. You know, these corporations and individuals who are in positions of privilege are stepping up to help people who are not. And the reality is that as the welfare state has grown, as the power and responsibilities of governments at all levels have grown, the church has weakened. Its people are less likely to help get involved. Its people are less likely to donate money to be involved. They throw money at their church and they tithe to their church and go, I'm glad they really do something. That food bank that we've got attached to our church is awesome. But they don't personally go and touch the people that are suffering. And then they get online and they talk about, you know, my church is helping victims of sex trafficking, and I'm really glad that we're doing that. That's awesome. What a great church I go to. And then the next post is these immigrant kids in camps that are being trafficked. They need to go back to where they came from, with no awareness whatsoever that the system that the United States government and its foreign policy has accelerated the demise of countries like El Salvador or Honduras, that drives more children and women to come into this country. You know, so I don't think people often connect all these different threads. And so for me, you know, from foreign policy and looking what happens in Syria and looking what happens when our bombs that we pay for are dropping on innocent people, I feel that. Like, I don't want that to happen. I don't want to be complicit in that system. And, you know, that goes to just every area. And so, you know, humanity is just at the core of libertarianism. It's taking responsibility for your neighbor and your community by taking care of yourself. And it's not communism. It's literally what the founders intended. You create strong communities of faith that care for people, and that really worked. It's why we have a Methodist hospital, because the Methodist church set up the Methodist hospital, set up the orphanage, set up the schools, mm-hmm. you know, set up the colleges. And, you know, people of faith were so much more active, and it's not like they're not. Like, Samaritan's Purse is building these hospitals in New York, and, you know, food banks, the charities that I talk to on a regular basis, they're all backed by people of faith. So God's people are still out there working, but it's a small percentage of the population compared to what it could be if we weren't all just outsourcing all this to a government.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I mean, I think that people, whenever they hear the concept of libertarianism, or they look at the candidates that have gained national notoriety, the Ron Pauls, to a lesser degree, the Rand Pauls, or Gary Johnson, Bill Weld. I'm trying to think of the people who have run on the libertarian ticket.
You think Ayn Rand and individualism?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You think it's a promotion of the individual, but what you're talking about is more community-driven libertarianism than...
It is individualism. And so what sticks in your mind is the left's propaganda around libertarianism for a couple reasons. First, libertarians don't do a great job of explaining it the way that I'm explaining it to you. Mm-hmm. They, you know, you see the messaging out of the libertarian movement right now is open the government. Okay, well, what about biology? Right? Like, if the government hadn't shut down, you'd still have a pandemic. You'd still have Smithfield in South Dakota where they were essential workers going to work, and now the whole company had to shut down because of that's one company. That would have happened everywhere, all over, right? So the message is, I don't care if people die. I'm going to do the wrong thing as soon as the government will let me. And mm-hmm. so libertarians often do the wrong – they don't understand how their voice comes across and reinforces the way that the media portrays them. The left – especially, but also opportunistic Republicans that, you know, my friends in the Republican Party, you were always good to me, but, you know, there are people like my friend Marcus Barlow, who I have a lot of respect for, but often it doesn't feel like a person like that has a lot of respect for me. You know, they want to mock libertarians, and you're just pot smoking Republicans. And, you know, I remember, you know, my friend Dan at the beer summit after the contentious 2010 Senate race, we had a little beer summit. They invited the token libertarian, and my friend Dan was looking at me and goes, "I don't know why you don't join the Republican Party." And then, like, not even 10 minutes later, he goes, "Oh, as soon as I hear about those Ron Paul crazies, I kick them out." You know, and I go, that's why I don't join the Republican Party. And so the messages that you get from the left and the right about libertarians shapes how you think about it, because you, the libertarians that you know generally reinforce those stereotypes, and they don't take the time. It's very difficult to talk about libertarianism through the lens of empathy, because it requires a certain level of skill that has taken me 20 years to develop, and I'm still not good at it. It's still, I have to practice this craft of talking about something that is propagandized as cruel and hateful in a way that is understood as loving and kind, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do at We Are Libertarians, and try to constantly just reinforce that message of, it is about individualism. You're responsible for yourself. You're responsible for your family. You're responsible for your community. If the government disappears tomorrow, you will be in charge of all of those things and every aspect of it. Are you ready? And are you ready to defend your community? Are you ready to take care of your community in the middle of a pandemic? Do you have those resources set? Well, if you don't, then you need to start saving, because in a libertarian society, the most important incentives drive everything, and consequences drive change, right? If our president never sees consequences, he doesn't get – there are consequences from people that are going to be against him no matter what, and he's gotten away with whatever he's wanted to because his allies never hold him accountable, you know. And you watch The Five the other day as he's talking about having total authority, and you see Jeanine Pirro want to say he's wrong, but she doesn't, because she doesn't want to hold him accountable. The WHO and China, nobody really has held China accountable on the South China Sea, and so China thinks they can do whatever they want. And so if they want to release or accidentally have escape a virus and then cover it up for 2 months, what are you going to do about it? You didn't do anything to Crimea, Russia and Crimea, when Crimea happened.
Yeah.
You know, if I want to go get my hair cut or go to a concert and infect 10,000 people in my community, what are you going to do about it? There's no consequences. And so government tends to take away the consequences. The media never faces consequences. So we are heading towards a consequence-free society, and it's making everything infinitely worse. Whereas in a libertarian society, you will face consequences. And so you have to be a better actor and take care of your community. And the incentive is to do that, because you will face consequences, and you don't want that. And so, it's tough, because libertarians are sometimes their own worst enemy. But I just have to always point out, like, look at your alternatives. It's Joe Biden and Donald Trump right now.
Yeah.
What is the lesser of two evils getting you?
Exactly. Speaking of our illustrious president, how do you think one maintains sanity these days, especially as a member of a third party in the age of Trump?
I don't know that I maintain my sanity. I follow a lot of social media. I follow a lot of media because what I try to do with We Are Libertarians is grab onto the discussion and grab onto the main points of all the different sides and inform you first. What I want to do is give you information. And what we do is we explain the context around the news, because what I'm finding is that, you know, for years we've been doing, if you have not listened to Dan Carlin's newest Common Sense episode about Caesar, you really should, because you especially would get a kick out of it. But your audience will really appreciate that episode. And, you know, in it, he kind of talks about we need news outlets that need to be the way that I'm not willing to be, which explain the news to you because you're not getting the basic facts, and then give you opinion. And that's what we do. We try to give you the details of what's actually happening and then have a conversation around the facts. And I think on my social media, I come across as sometimes I'm leftist and sometimes I'm a Trump supporter and sometimes I'm supporting – I'm a have Trump derangement syndrome. And so I think in the context of my podcast where you have an hour or two to expand on something, it makes logical, clear sense. But in the social media world, I can come across as very like – this guy can't figure out what he is today. And that's because my attempt at consistency is always going to be against the person who is the government, who is the president of the United States, as many Republicans have forgotten that this man is the government and is a politician. But I'm also against, I'm also against a lot of Democrats, and I'm also against, you know, so I don't know. I think I try to balance what I'm against as well as what I'm for. And I do that by just trying to drill down and understand all the different arguments, try to find facts, try to listen to sane people. And just object where things are objectionable and agree where things are agreeable. And, you know, sometimes Donald Trump says the right thing. Like, he's not wrong about the World Health Organization. China put their guy in charge of the World Health Organization, and so when they messed up, their guy was there to protect them. He's not wrong about that. Yeah. But he's also wrong about saying he has total authority and the 10th Amendment doesn't matter. And so, you know, in the world of social media, you're a Trump supporter on one side and have Trump derangement syndrome on the other, when really you're just being consistent in that people need to be held accountable. Donald Trump should be held accountable by the states, and the World Health Organization should be held accountable by the United States. So it's the only way to sanity is to be well informed, because what happens when people are – we have such a manipulative culture right now that we don't trust any institutions anymore, because they've either discredited themselves or we've listened to people that have discredited institutions. So you stop trusting them and start trusting the politicians or the media that follows Donald Trump, for instance, or the media itself propagandizes and says, don't listen to those people, only listen to us. Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro, bad. New York Times, good. Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson say New York Times bad, Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro good. You again have to evaluate the incentives. If somebody is telling you that you should only listen to them and everyone else is not worth your time, that person is a cult leader. They're not in, they don't have your best interest at mind. Someone said today, you know, Dave Ramsey says the economy is going to be really bad. Why do you think Dave Ramsey's wrong? Well, Dave Ramsey sells products that help you get financially ready. So if you live in a state of fear that the economy is about to collapse, you're probably more likely to buy his product. He may not do that knowingly, but deep down, the incentive is for you to buy something that Dave Ramsey is selling you.
Yeah. Now,
so you have to understand that all of these people that you listen to have an incentive in manipulating you. And that includes me, and that includes you. You know, as people who are trying to build an audience. And so we're trying to get you to do something for our own personal benefit. And so what I try to do is in my show notes, show all my homework. I put sometimes hundreds of links or dozens of links, you know, in a PDF for people to go, this is all the stuff that me and my team looked at before we did this episode. Because if you understand all the arguments or you understand some basic facts, you feel so much more in control. And if you feel in control, you are less likely to be manipulated by people who want to manipulate you into their camp. And it's a lot of work sometimes, but what I tell people is read Reason magazine, read National Review, read Vox, and read the New York Times website every day. Read those four things, and then listen to a few news podcasts that you like. And that will generally get you what you need to know without a lot of hysteria.
Seems fair enough. I mean, you know, I follow your Twitter feed and I follow you on Facebook. And the one thing that I have appreciated about your feeds, other than the fact that you post some hilarious memes.
Thank you.
I mean, you are...
If I can get you to stay following me for the memes, then I can get the libertarian screed in there.
But the thing is I'll follow your feeds, and I'll see that you will... You call out BS, is what I've noticed. So that when... So for an example, and you've kind of alluded to this, like if Donald Trump is saying something that is actually right, and you have someone on, you know, basically going against him simply because he's Donald Trump, whether it's a member of the media or if it's someone else, you're calling that out because in that sense, the president is right, as he was about, you know, the WHO. But if you see someone defending Trump's total authority, you're going to call that out too, because frankly, it's incorrect. It doesn't have that.
Principles. And I'll even hold my own accountable. Ron Paul, I think, has been embarrassing through all of this stuff. And there are a lot of great libertarian people that I think have just been on the wrong side of this stuff and they're too prideful to do what Richard Epstein did, which he's a Stanford fellow who is one of the smartest people I've ever followed. I mean, I think Richard Epstein's a genius, but he had it so wrong a month or two ago and has come out and said, I made the biggest mistake of my career saying that this was all a hoax, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got it wrong and I'm sorry. And there's a lot of people that didn't do that. And so now, instead of, you know, manning up and saying I was wrong, that because from the beginning, I've just said, listen, this is – yes, it is true that the media cries is the boy who cried wolf. They're using attention and scare tactics to try and get you to follow them and to get clicks. Like if you walk into the Indy Star or any of these major newsrooms, there's a big row of TVs that show the top clicked links for the website that day. Well, the incentive then for the reporter is to write something that gets them on that board. And so the reality is that this is a wolf. Like, there was a wolf around the corner. And so early on, for me, it was important to find out what that wolf was, where that wolf was, what that wolf looked like, what that wolf would do, how it was going to operate. And I took a lot of crap from a lot of libertarians and Trump fans saying, you're bursting into hysterics, you're supporting the government shutdown, not having the ability. Those people didn't have the ability to separate the biology from the politics. And you have to be able to separate the biology from the politics in this particular pandemic, because you can effectively make the case that the government has largely made the shutdown unevenly applied. It's made it worse. It's going to make the economic crisis worse long term. There are government bad actors. It came out today that Japan was intentionally not testing people so they didn't have bad tested positive numbers to keep the Olympics going in the summertime. They lied to their public, and now the Japanese people are going to pay the price. That's an evil act. And so as a libertarian, you can say this person should be locked up. Abe should be locked up for that. So there's plenty you look at the FDA and the CDC, and you can make the libertarian case that the CDC and the FDA made it so that there was one point of success and one point of failure, and it was in their hands, and they failed, and that is why you have to stay indoors for 6 months. And if they had dispersed that, let private labs, and had dozens of points of success or failure, we'd be in a much different situation right now. And so the government failed you, and Donald Trump is responsible for that because he appointed the heads of those agencies. But, you know, so that's a very libertarian case that is unpopular on all sides, because the FDA and the CDC to the left are really important, and Donald Trump is responsible for nothing to the right. And so it comes across sometimes as scatterbrained. But, you know, Ron Paul has, you know, just posted an article saying that you shouldn't get the coronavirus vaccine that doesn't even exist yet and won't be available maybe ever. But Ron Paul is coming out against the vaccine, right? Well, Ron Paul sells a homeschool curriculum. And homeschoolers homeschoolers by and large are very anti-vax. And so he's getting clicks. So you click on his website to read his opinion and his pop-up to buy his homeschool curriculum comes up, and you go, okay, the incentive here is that he is trying to get you to buy his product. He's he's putting out false information that it, he called the, you know, the media is scaremongering you into getting this vaccine. Well, dude, if you're telling people not to get a vaccine that doesn't exist, you don't have information on whether that is a good vaccine or a bad vaccine, right? You're scaremongering yourself. And so,
yeah, he is a fearmonger.
Yeah, I'll call out libertarians too. The Ron Paul has the hardest core cult. I mean, so I just think, you know, I think fundamentally I hate people being lied to and manipulated. I am I don't know what it is in my past, or maybe I do and I don't want to talk about it here, that just makes me see red when I see people being lied to. Because I think it's doing the work that I've done and talking to audiences at the personal, you know, I talk to hundreds of people a week at Bob and Tom. I talk to dozens of people a week at the podcasts. And these are great people. I mean, dozens to hundreds of people a week are just so nice to me and so nice about the people that I work with and so nice about the things that I do. And they're just trying to get along. And, you know, I just talked to so many, again, it goes back to that empathy thing. Like, I just talked to so many good people who don't really know what's going on, and they just kind of pay attention because they're just trying to survive. And then you've got people like Ron Paul or Donald Trump or Nancy Pelosi out here just trying to manipulate for their own personal gain. And it makes me crazy. And yeah, have the attention and the time to detail how this stuff is wrong and that they're lying to you. And I just I hate it. I hate people being manipulative. And, you know, and I'm sure over the course of my work, I have or will do that myself. And I have tried to build an audience that will call me out when I do it. Mm-hmm. Almost to an annoying point, Josh, that when I say anything, it's sources. I appreciate it. I'm glad I have that kind of audience.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. As you can tell, this conversation is far from done. There is still so much ground to cover with Chris Spangle. So please tune in again next time for part two of this fascinating discussion. As always, be sure to follow The Political Nomad on the socials, facebook.com/thenomadpod, @thenomadpod on Twitter, and if you're on Instagram, The Political Nomad. If you're watching this on YouTube, please like this video, subscribe to this channel, and click the bell to get notified every time I upload a new video. Also, sign up for the weekly newsletter, The Nomad News. It's the only place you can get access to the political road trip playlists for every show. You can sign up today at joshgillespie.com. And subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or any of your favorite podcast platforms. So tune in next week for part two of my interview with Chris Spangle. See you next time.